From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, as Attorney General Bill Schuette fights to preserve the ban on straight ticket voting, municipal clerks fear a logistical nightmare.
And at this point, by them dragging out the decision on this, also drags out preparing the ballots to go to print in a timely fashion.
Why Michigan needs to be a part of the latest industrial revolution.
We need to understand that Michigan makes things, that Michigan is industry. We are the state that makes stuff.
Electroconvulsive therapy, offering hope to patients with severe mental illness.
When you can correct that and you can get them into remission, 60 to 90% of the time, it is a miracle in many ways.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Attorney General Bill Schuette continues pressing his case to reinstate Michigan's ban on straight ticket voting, the clock is ticking. Ticking for city and county clerks all over the state who need to have the ballots ready to go. Also, besides averting a potential explosion, are there enough incentives for utilities to plug natural gas leaks?
In most states, most utilities get fully reimbursed for any gas that leaks out.
But first, if you find yourself dissatisfied with the choices offered by the two mainstream political parties, you have a new choice as of today. The Working Class Party got itself onto the Michigan ballot after more than 50,000 people signed petitions, quite a lot more than the 31,566 signatures required by election law. With us now is Marianne Herring of the Working Class Party. And Marianne, let's start at the beginning. What is the Working Class Party?
We are a party of laboring population, whether we're retirees, teachers, auto workers, students, people on Social Security, people who are struggling to live with part-time jobs or contractual jobs or two-tier jobs. 2 years ago, some of us decided to let the voice of the working class be heard in the elections. We don't have to look any further than the crises that we see in the state of Michigan. Flint and the Detroit Public Schools. Both parties, Republicans and Democrats, are implicated in these tragic circumstances for people, whether it's the poisoning of children of Flint, the killing of people with Legionnaire's disease, children suffering brain damage, population being ignored when Flint residents kept saying over and over again, this is a problem. And even though it goes down in history as the problem of Governor Snyder, the federal EPA is really dominated by Democrats, and they ignored the warning signs about this disaster for 2 years. So we're giving them equal opportunity as far as blame is concerned.
So plenty of blame to be ladled out, in your view, to both parties.
Absolutely. What's happening to public education? You don't have to talk to me. You can talk to the thousands of people we talked to when we petitioned to get on the ballot. Education was a huge issue throughout many working class school districts, but when you look at the destruction, the conscious destruction of the Detroit public schools, that's another, you know, central reason why we stood up and said enough is enough. The two political parties, Republicans and Democrats, represent the interests of big business, of the banks. The legislature serves their interest, and the working class has no political voice. So into that we stepped and said, enough is enough. It's time for the working class to be able to express itself at the polls and have its own party.
Now, were you surprised to get over 50,000 signatures when, you know, that's nearly 20,000 more than was required to get you on the ballot?
It was a huge effort. There were about 69 people who pulled together in this effort to circulate the petitions. There was not a lot of us. But from the very beginning, when we started on January 16th, the coldest day of the winter, we had incredible response from people who stopped, despite the weather conditions, all the way up through July 9th when we stopped petitioning, where people literally said, we are so fed up. This is such a great idea. Where can I sign? Not to mention the thousands of stories we heard as far as people's situation, whether it was Teamsters having their pensions cut, parents being nickeled and dimed for fundraising so their kids could have a sports activity, people on Social Security who didn't get an increase. I mean, it resonated in the populations where we petitioned, which were primarily in working class districts.
Do you feel you're speaking as much to people in northern Michigan or in the Upper Peninsula as you are to that base of support that you pulled in southeast Michigan?
I can't imagine that we wouldn't have had tremendous response also in other districts because the education's under attack nationwide. Social Security nationwide, jobs nationwide, you know, whether it's you're talking about the UP where people are really, really struggling. It's my understanding we had petitions signed from every county in the state of Michigan except for like four because we met people at different places. And people said, will this be something we can vote for where we live? And we said, yes, if we get on the ballot, we intend to at least have a candidacy that's a statewide candidacy.
And with that, let me ask you, so what will we see on the November ballot? For what offices are they running? I know you're running for office, are you not?
Yes. You will see on the ballot three candidates for the Working Class Party this year. Myself, for member of the State Board of Education. I have been teaching for many years. I'm a well-known in the Dearborn Public Schools, but I'm an advocate for public education across the board. We are also reinforcing this statewide position by running two workers, and we're going to consistently link all three candidacies together for the Working Class Party. One of the auto workers is a longtime militant at Chrysler. He's now retired, Sam Johnson. The second auto worker who is on the slate is a longtime Ford worker. His name is Gary Walkowicz. He has led the struggles against two-tiered wages and against concessions in the UAW.
And what offices are Gary and Sam running for?
Sam Johnson is running for 13th District, Congress in the 13th District, Gary Walkowicz, Congress in the 12th District.
You know, some have wondered aloud, Marianne, why not see parties like yours, like the Working Class Party and the Green Party and the Libertarian Party unite and create a large cohesive option for voters who are looking at both the mainstream parties and their presidential candidates and they can't support either one of them. So those are voters who are really ripe for the picking. Why not band together?
I don't think it's the issue of large. I think it's the issue of policy. There are some independent parties that we do not have agreement. We think that the working class has the capability, when it's organized, to solve the problems that the working class faces. And it's like saying you have to have a particular tool to work on a carburetor. You don't pick the biggest tool that you have. You pick the tool that actually works. And we think working class organized, when it actually fights for what we need as a population, can solve the problems that we face, whether it's the question of quality, excellent public education, the issue of jobs, the issue of roads, and it requires the working class organized. We deliberately are focusing on the class that actually does the work to make the society run. And we do not say just electing us will solve the problem. We say openly in our literature, we'll say when we campaign that we believe the working class, when it's organized, can fight to change the problems and correct the problems that it faces.
Is this not the approach that the Communist Party took when it was trying to organize, even back looking at the 50s?
You're not talking about the 50s. I would say you're talking about the workers' movement of the 1930s.
Mm.
But I'm very, very confident in the history when the working class has organized together. And yes, there were communist and socialist groups in the working class that played a central role in what today people know to be many of the gains that the working class saw in this society, whether it's for the right for Social Security, for workers' comp, for the right to be organized in their own union organizations. But I will reference history since you brought it up. I would say I would more point to the candidacy of the Working Class Party. 100 years ago, his name was Eugene V. Debs, who said, the bosses have their own parties, the workers, working class, we need our own party.
Now, let me ask you this. Are there other working class parties in other states?
There have been historically, and over the years, there have been different socialist groups, to my knowledge, who have been on the ballot. But I am not at this moment familiar with an organization that says working class party in other states.
Marianne, what is your goal for the working class party in this election cycle right now, leading up to November 2016?
The goal is to give the thousands and thousands and thousands of working class people, the laboring population, whether people are retired, unemployed, underemployed, a way to express what they really think in the elections, that we need our own political voice, and we have confidence that we can do, working class people would do an excellent job of solving the problems, because the current political parties have put the crisis on the backs of the laboring population. We think that, we're through with anything to do with lesser of two evils. I will quote Eugene V. Debs and say, I would rather vote for something I want and not get it than vote for something I don't want and get it.
Marianne Herring is one of the organizers of the Working Class Party and a candidate for the State Board of Education on that Working Class Party ballot. And we want to thank you for being, actually not ballot, let me say that again. Marianne Herring is one of the organizers of the Working Class Party, and you will see her name as a candidate for the State Board of Education. Thank you so much for speaking with us today and telling us about the Working Class Party, Marianne.
Thank you so much for having us on the show.
And we always like to hear from you. Tell us, what stories are you focusing on, or issues that you want to hear more about, or people that we need to find out about and share their story with Michigan? Just let us know. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Stateside Radio, always at michiganradio.org, and just click the link that says Stateside. Up next, just how many industrial revolutions have there been, and why is it so important to Michigan's economy? You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Experimentation.
Curiosity.
The next idea.
Technology alone is not enough.
You probably remember studying about the Industrial Revolution back in school, that time a couple of centuries ago when America and Europe shifted from rural farming societies to urban industrial societies. Well, did you know we're already in the era of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, Industry 4.0? What is it, and what's at stake for Michigan? Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is a leader in the effort to bring Michigan businesses into this new era of making things. Tom Kelly is the COO of Automation Alley, Michigan's leading technology business association. He'll become its executive director August 27th. Tom, so good to have you with us on The Next Idea.
Well, thank you, Cindy. Happy to be here.
Your essay digs right into about how critical it is to get Michigan businesses on board with this new industrial revolution, Industry 4.0. What is it? What does that mean?
Well, Industry 4.0 means the fourth industrial revolution. The first, back in the 1800s, was steam. The second was in the 20s and 30s with electricity and Henry Ford in the assembly line. The third was, if you remember back in the 80s, the advent of computers and robots and factory automation. And the fourth one is just beginning, and it's really the most critical. It is the marriage of the digital with the physical. If you think about virtual reality and what's happening on the consumer side, industry is going to go through this inflection just as much as the consumer side, if not 10 times more so. Industry 4.0 is about the digital meeting the physical, and it's going to transform everything everywhere.
And is it already happening?
It's already happening, absolutely. The thing we need to be concerned about is not only is it already happening, but Industry 4.0 is a collection of technologies. So think autonomous robots, simulation, big data, 3D printing, cybersecurity, the cloud, the industrial Internet of Things. These are all technologies that any one of them in their own right would be very disruptive to a business. Imagine all of them coming at once. And you're a small or medium or large manufacturer, and you have to figure out, what does all this technology that's washing over me mean for my business and how I'm going to go to market? It's incredible, incredible change and disruption.
So this is not the time to say, well, we've always done it like this and it has worked well.
Absolutely not. Do that at your own peril, because the world, the change is coming so rapidly. You really have to embrace change and say, this is going to be the world we live in. Everything is going virtual. Everything is going digital. Computers are here to stay. Robots are coming. Autonomous vehicles are coming. All the things we read about. And it's going to make our lives better. But by the same token, it's going to change a lot of how we go to market. From our perspective, our job is to help industry. And not just the big guys. You know, the big guys in Industry 4.0 are going to be fine. They have lots of brains, they have lots of capital, and they can make a lot of mistakes. Because when they're wrong, they just go buy somebody who's right, and they bring them into the organization. If you're small or medium, you don't have the luxury of having a lot of R&D or making a lot of mistakes. You have to rely on people like Automation Alley to, as a collective, investigate a lot of different avenues and come up with the right solutions for small and medium companies. And that's what we do.
So that's why Automation Alley is such a good resource, I'm hearing you say, to these small and medium-sized businesses.
That's right. We're a good resource because we're a collection of very smart, small, medium, and large manufacturers and technology companies that are all trying to solve these problems. So we pull together groups that are focused on autonomous robots. We have another group focused on cybersecurity. We'll have a group focused on 3D printing. And you bring all these people together, and you're able to cross-share this information to say, what is the path forward for all of these disruptive technologies at once? And that's what we do and why it's so helpful to these smalls.
Tom Kelly, you have launched startups before, and I'm wondering, what do you think will be more challenging in this changeover to Industry 4.0, retrofitting the older businesses or launching new ones that have to embrace this technology before they even start making anything?
You know, having done startups, as you said, Cindy, it is difficult. I don't want to minimize how difficult it is to start a business. I think it's going to be even more challenging for the businesses that are existing today. And the reason for that is you have to, in some ways, abandon what you've always known has worked. And to take that leap of faith to begin the change to a digital world. And it's new for everybody. Everybody in business, in industry, in commerce, digital is new. And so we're navigating all these new paths to market. Think of on the consumer side. You know, Amazon didn't have to worry about all these brick-and-mortar stations all over the country, buildings. What Amazon is able to do is disrupt the market completely because they're a startup and they didn't have to deal with old business models. If you look at a Walmart, they're trying to catch up, and they're saying, look, I need to marry the digital with the physical. Now, ultimately, that's going to be a very successful model, but you have to go through a lot of pain to get there. If you bring it over to the industrial side, think of all the pain that we have to get through to understand how the digital and the physical will play together, and that's exactly what Industry 4.0 is.
Besides changes in technology that surround manufacturing that'll be part of Industry 4.0, you also believe there needs to be a change in the way manufacturing jobs are perceived. What are those changes? Why do they matter?
Well, the change is profound. If I gave you job descriptions where I said database management, cybersecurity, software, and programming, you would think, oh, you're talking about the IT industry. But according to Boston Consulting Group, those are the top three jobs that will be required for a manufacturer in just a short 5 or 6 years from now. It's profound when you think, I'm a manufacturer and the top three jobs that I'm going to create are going to be all around the IT industry because it's the digital meeting the physical. And I found that just overwhelmingly difficult to comprehend that everybody is going to be a technology company, including manufacturers.
Which, as you point out in your essay, sets out the challenge for schools, colleges, universities in our state, doesn't it?
It really does. And we're going to have to learn faster. I think it's important to recognize that schools, educational institutions, the knowledge transfer has to be more along the lines of, you have a skill set and you need to know this certification to go do that specific job, as opposed to being a generalist. You're going to be much more focused on certifications. And if you think about it, it makes sense. It's the way the IT industry has gone in a lot of ways. You know, you're an expert in SAP, or you're an expert in Cisco systems, or you're an expert in Microsoft, and those programming languages, you become experts in different ones. And that's who the IT industry seeks out. And you're going to see that in manufacturing, where it becomes very important to have specific skill sets. And we need to be ready for that.
Something in your essay for the next idea, a phrase jumped out at me, Tom. You write, if there's going to be a manufacturing industry in Michigan in the years to come, which leads me to ask, what is at stake here for Michigan and its businesses of all sizes?
We need to understand that Michigan makes things, that Michigan is industry. It's how our skill set has developed over the hundreds of years that we've been a state. We are the state that makes stuff, and we need to embrace our heritage, our backstory, if you will. We're not going to have the ability to become the best textile group in the country. You know, we're focused on making things, and it's not just about autos. What we need to understand is we have a wonderful opportunity in Michigan to redefine ourselves around what we've already are good at, which is making things. So we make cars, but all of the plants that are making cars and all the tier 2, 3, 4, and 5 suppliers that are making parts for cars, you're going to find that all of those parts are going to become digitized. They're all going to have sensors on them. We're all going to be participating in this digital world, and that's going to turn them all into technology companies. And not only that, it's going to turn them into companies that will be able to make a lot of everything. So we have this great opportunity in Michigan to own Industry 4.0 and to become a major player in the world around Industry 4.0. But we need to recognize that that exists within us and that it's our birthright to own that.
Tom Kelly is the COO of Automation Alley. His essay on the fourth industrial revolution, Industry 4.0, can be found on the Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. And as always, we welcome your comments. Tom, thank you so much for being a part of the Next Idea.
Thank you, Cindy. I really enjoyed the time.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
The natural gas industry tells us using natural gas is environmentally friendly. The industry points to fewer impurities, tells us its combustion yields mainly carbon dioxide and water vapor, so less pollution. But the main ingredient of natural gas is methane, and methane is one of the biggest contributors to climate change. That's why University of Michigan Public Policy Assistant Professor Katie Hausman says we need to worry about what's happening to the environment when natural gas with its methane leaks. She believes utilities have very little incentive to plug natural gas leaks. Katie Hausman, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What is fugitive methane?
Whenever natural gas gets transported or put through a processing system, it can leak out. And it can do that sort of surface stations through valves. It can do it from pipelines. The natural gas seeps out of the system in small amounts that start to add up. And a big component of that natural gas is, as you said, methane, which is a contributor to climate change.
So this is a normal part of the whole supply chain process of getting
from
natural gas.
From start to finish, yep.
How much is leaking out? How big a problem is this?
That's a big open question, and scientists have disagreed a lot. One of the reasons my co-author and I wanted to get into this research was that we saw all this great research coming out of the sciences and the engineering side, trying to get a sense of how much is leaking. And what we didn't see was nearly as much research on why it's leaking, what's being done to prevent those leaks, or what sort of incentives natural gas utilities might face. And so we wanted to zero in on that part of the problem.
And what did you find? Why? First the why.
So first, the why. I think when you look at natural gas utilities, there's two big incentives that you need to think about. Something you might hear from a lot of analysts, especially natural gas industry analysts, is, well, why would we let natural gas leak out of our system? That's the product we're trying to sell. Why wouldn't we want to plug those leaks and sell it to somebody? And that's certainly true. But there's two other parts that maybe those analysts aren't thinking about or aren't talking about. And the first part is that the value to society is a lot bigger for those leaks than the value to the company. And that's because of those climate change damages. The simplest example to think about is if a natural gas company lets some amount of gas leak out of its system, maybe there's a technology it could use to plug that leak. Suppose that technology costs $10 to implement.
Okay.
When it implements that technology, it'll prevent a leak that might be worth $2 to $4 to that company in terms of the commodity value, what they can get by buying and selling gas, $2 to $4. But when you look at the climate change damages, it's more like $25 to $30, according to the calculations in our paper. So the company's not going to do that because they would lose $6 to $8 implementing that technology. But society, the American public, would certainly like them to implement it.
Well explained. So what's the answer then? Since there does not seem to be this economic incentive, is that because the price of natural gas is so low?
It's partly the gap has been getting wider over time as natural gas prices have fallen. But there's always been that wedge. Even when natural gas prices were substantially higher in the early 2000s, you still had that big disparity. This is your standard environmental damages problem from any economics textbook. And the answer is to price at the environmental damages level, not just at the commodity value level. But for natural gas utilities that bring gas into your home or into my home, into businesses, the problem is even more severe. There's not just that difference between the $2 to $4 commodity value and the $25 to $30 climate change value. There's actually even less incentive for that natural gas utility. Now I'm going to zero in on the distribution utilities. Those are the ones that bring natural gas to your home, to my home. We use it to heat our homes, to heat our water.
Yeah.
I value it a lot in our cold Michigan winters. And that natural gas utility faces pretty strict economic regulations at the state level. And the reason is that it's usually the only provider of natural gas in one area. So you don't get to go out and sort of shop around. You have to buy gas from that one utility. That makes sense. You don't want three utilities running gas lines through one street. That wouldn't be efficient. But because they're the only provider, the state regulates the prices that the utility can charge you. And part of that process is that in most states, most utilities get fully reimbursed for any gas that leaks out.
Oh, so even less economic incentive if they're being reimbursed.
Exactly. Even less incentive if you have partial or full reimbursement. And historically, maybe that wasn't very important. Maybe it wasn't that much money we were talking about. The utilities would say this is a cost of doing business. We need to be reimbursed for it, just like we're reimbursed for any other costs, for our equipment costs or our labor costs. But as we've come to understand the climate change implications, I think we're coming to understand that that sort of regulatory distortion is worse than what we thought it was.
All right. So then what model do you propose that would fix this in a sense and impose those incentives for utilities to keep the leaks to a minimum? And even more importantly, in whose lap is the responsibility?
It's a tricky problem. I think three things need to happen. One is the reimbursement rules need to be changed, of course. And slowly they have been changing. Some states are implementing caps or more scrutiny over the amount leaked. But that's not going to be enough. You still need to charge for the full environmental damages, not just the commodity value. But those two things combined are going to face one really tricky problem, which is accurate measurement. We know something about how much utilities leak, but the measure that we have is pretty noisy. It's going to be politically difficult to implement a really stringent regulation based off that noisy measurement.
When you say noisy, what do you mean by that? That's an interesting term.
Something like a third of the measurements are actually negative, meaning gas utilities are selling more than they are buying. That's clearly not true, but it tells you something about the quality of the data that we're working with.
Not that great.
Not that great. So we have ways in our research to get around that problem, but putting in place a really strict environmental regulation on something that's measured so poorly is, of course, going to be politically challenging. And that's true not just at the level of the sort of local pipelines, but throughout the natural gas supply chain. We need better measurement that's more precise and more accurate.
And if we don't get a grip on this and get a grip on plugging these natural gas leaks?
we don't get a grip on this, it's going to continue to be a big contributor to climate change as the natural gas industry grows because of the development of new fracking technologies. It's just going to be a bigger and bigger problem. As other countries implement fracking, it's going to be a problem there too.
What role do people who care about climate change, what role can they play in this trying to affect a reforming of the way that we treat the natural gas supply chain and allow for leaking?
Understanding what the administration, the federal administration, is doing on methane leaks throughout the supply chain. My research focused on sort of within city networks, but the federal administration is imposing new regulations from wellhead through the supply chain, and that's going to be really important going forward. I don't want to throw out the natural gas sector. It can have big advantages over coal. I don't think the answer is to shut down natural gas. The answer is to keep that natural gas but have a better handle on the leaks.
Katie Hausman is an assistant professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. Her piece on why utilities have so little incentive to plug leaking natural gas, it can be found at theconversation.com. Katie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Still to come, municipal clerks are the ones who are responsible to make sure the ballots are perfectly accurate for every election. Well, it turns out that takes a whole lot more than just spell checking and hitting print. And with Michigan's straight ticket ban still stuck in federal court limbo, the pressure is building to have those ballots ready to go in time. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing with our series, Minding Michigan, as we explore mental health issues in our state. Turning now to electroconvulsive therapy, ECT. It's a mental health treatment that can be powerfully effective, but largely because of the way it's been portrayed in film or television, ECT is wrapped in stigma and misconception. The University of Michigan Department of Psychiatry has just opened a new mental health unit that expands its ability to offer electroconvulsive therapy to patients. Dr. Daniel Maxner is director of the U of M ECT program. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just exactly what does ECT do and how does it do it?
ECT is a very brief treatment where we're inducing a brief seizure under anesthesia, so it's a very controlled treatment where there's a lot of medical monitoring going on. And what we're doing is drifting off a patient to sleep for about 5 minutes, and then muscles are relaxed with another medication. And then a brief electrical stimulation is applied to the scalp, and that induces a seizure. And this seizure is the therapeutic part of the treatment. It has many biologic effects that, you know, from various lines of research that we know, has a lot of different biological effects.
Is it kind of like hitting sometimes when a computer jams up and you hit the reset button and kind of, you know, restart it? Does it kind of do that to the brain?
In very simplistic terms, I think that we use that analogy a fair amount. It's one of those things, though, that the reset button may have to be pushed a few times. In a course of treatment, it tends to be an average of about 9 treatments for most patients to get better from their bad depression or other illness.
Now, let's talk about the kind of patients that most benefit from ECT. What would be some of the conditions that you've seen in your experience it's the most useful?
The vast majority of patients are depressed patients that have had what we call treatment-resistant depression. Sometimes the patients are extremely sick. They might be in the hospital. They may not be eating or drinking. Depression, by and large, is the majority of patients that we treat. However, there are other illnesses such as bipolar illness where there may be manic episodes. And so on the high side of that particular mood disorder, ECT can be used very effectively for that as well. Another area is psychosis, when psychosis is out of control or resistant to medications. And some patients with schizophrenia may also have benefit with ECT with the right patient selection.
Now, doctor, I know that you know, for most of the public, what we know of electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, is what we see in popular culture when we watch TV or movies. I'm thinking of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. We saw that. The film A Beautiful Mind, where Russell Crowe's character John Nash undergoes a number of treatments in the 1950s for paranoid schizophrenia. That was tough to watch. And then the Showtime series Homeland comes to mind, where Claire Danes' character of Carrie Matheson battles bipolar disorder, so she undergoes ECT. And again, this is supposed to be modern times. It looked violent and it looked rough. When you see these scenes, do you cringe?
Most definitely. In fact, I try not to watch most of them, but I do.
Why?
Because it's such a false portrayal. My father was a physician as well, and he always laughed at how Hollywood portrays medicine in general. And then for me, being a psychiatrist and doing this treatment that carries a lot of stigma, it's very, you know, difficult to stomach in a lot of ways.
Is it your sense that perhaps if someone could be helped by ECT, if they've watched Homeland and seen Claire Danes reenacting this violent treatment, that they might not want to go in that direction?
Correct. I mean, if you look at the past portrayals of ECT in the movies and in TV, you'll see that it went from being a drastic but yet potentially helpful treatment to something that's actually punishing and violent. And
like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And in that particular movie, if you really think about it, that movie had about 30 seconds of ECT portrayed, but that is one of the biggest hurdles that I face as a clinician trying to explain what ECT is to patients. They continually bring that up to me, even during consultations, and it happened just today as well.
Wow, and that movie is 40 years old.
Correct.
Stop and think. So it really did stick in people's minds. And then that term, shock therapy. What do you think when you hear people refer to it as shock therapy?
Well, you know, you can either embrace the old term or you can try to ditch the old term. I try to ditch the old term myself, but sometimes when you're trying to educate the public, you may want to just use what's in the common vernacular and educate from there. People that come to mind that have done such a thing is a mentor of one of my mentors at the University of Michigan, a person who's written books on patient education, family education about ECT, has actually used that term, shock therapy, in the title of his book. Another person that's done the same thing is Kitty Dukakis. So in 2006, she wrote a book that used the same term, shock therapy, and explained how shock therapy helped her and deal with her depression and was life-saving.
If you were to take, let's say, the modern representation, such as I watched just a season or two ago on Homeland, where Carrie Matheson has this ECT. How do you compare with what you see every day as you treat people with ECT? What is it like for the patient?
Well, the patient comes into the treatment room, and it's a very calm environment, typically. You have multiple healthcare professionals. You have an anesthesia team that's there. And again, it's a very calm environment where there's no buzzing of machines. And in fact, we'll have some music in the room, and sometimes I'll have patients, you know, select music that mm-hmm. they want to have for the room. And then the medication, you know, it's an IV that's started, and then a medication drifts them to sleep for about 5 minutes only. So it's a very brief treatment. So patients have this image like they're going to be out for a long time. They're going to be violently shaking and so forth under anesthesia, and it's very anxiety provoking for them. However, in reality, it's a very quick treatment where they're literally only asleep for 5 minutes, and after the brief seizure is over, which we monitor with brainwave monitoring, and there is
because you know what you're going for.
We're monitoring that very closely, and there's no violent shaking or anything like that you might see on TV or in the movies.
And when they wake up, what do they feel?
You know, just like when you wake up from a surgery, you might feel a little bit groggy and tired after surgery, and it takes about, you know, 15 to 30 minutes to wake up. Our recovery nurses, you know, help them wake up and orient and make sure they're clear and have something to eat or drink, and pretty soon, within 30, 60 minutes, they're dressing and getting ready to go home.
You say this is a miracle, this treatment. You've used that term. Why?
Well, when I was a very junior physician learning psychiatry at the University of Michigan, when I did my training 20-some years ago, I saw patients receive ECT, and it became clear to me that it was something I really wanted to do in my practice. And you see patients who are catatonic. You see patients who are literally on death's door in a lot of ways. They're not eating and drinking. They're extremely withdrawn. And or they're just extremely miserable. They're suicidal. They're dangerously ill. And when you can correct that and you can get them into remission 60 to 90% of the time, it is a miracle in many ways.
If I were to ask you, what would you say to someone who has been told that they should consider electroconvulsive therapy, what would that be?
I would tell them to, you know, make sure you get a really thorough evaluation going into ECT or any treatment that is perceived as being, you know, fairly invasive, that you'd want to have a very good thorough evaluation to make sure that it's the appropriate treatment for you. I spend quite a bit of time in my evaluations evaluating the whole picture of the patient, not only just the depression symptoms, but the psychosocial situation, the family dynamics, what's happening, the stressors that they might be undergoing, as well as trying to understand, are they really resistant? Have they tried other treatment strategies that might be appropriate for them ahead of ECT? But not to be fearful that if it's recommended, that it should be something that you should really consider.
Your program at U of M is one of the few to treat teens with electroconvulsive therapy.
Correct.
Why is it not more widely offered?
The reasons stem from, you know, not a lot of clinicians do ECT in this patient population. So I think that is one big issue. One of my colleagues a number of years ago did a survey of psychologists and psychiatrists where they asked about their exposure to ECT. Did they see that in their practice? Do they recommend ECT for their adolescent patients? And the results were alarmingly low as far as what they really understood about ECT and whether they were actually referring for this treatment. So I think there's a lot of educational parts of this where the clinicians are not trained in where ECT may be appropriate. I think that's a big problem right there. One big issue for me is that what people don't understand is that mental illness does not really care about an age. Just like cancer or any other major life-threatening illness, mental illness, depression, doesn't really care whether you're 98 or whether you're, you know, 18.
Such a good point. Dr. Daniel Maxner, director of the ECT program, electroconvulsive therapy program at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for speaking with us and clearing away some of the Hollywood misconceptions.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Election Day is drawing near, less than 90 days to go. And still, the battle continues over straight ticket voting in Michigan. That's where you can make one move to vote for every candidate from the party of your choice. State Attorney General Bill Schuette has filed an emergency motion with the Federal Appeals Court, asking that appeals court to overrule lower court rulings blocking the new GOP-led law that eliminates straight ticket voting in Michigan. As the legal sparring continues, guess who's caught in the crossfire? Municipal clerks and other election officials. They're the ones responsible for having the ballots ready for us come Election Day. And this fighting over straight ticket voting is shaping up to be a logistical nightmare. Here to tell us why is Sarah Biladek. She is the Walker City Clerk and the president of the Michigan Association of Municipal Clerks. Sarah, how are you and your colleagues feeling right now with this legal sparring going on?
Well, to say the least, we're very nervous that this could cause great demise in receiving our ballots in a timely manner, especially for our military overseas voters, which by state law, there's a deadline of September 24th to have the ballots in hand to be able to mail them if need be. And at this point, by them dragging out the decision on this, also drags out preparing the ballots to go to print in a timely fashion.
I think it's safe to assume, Sarah, most of us turn up on Election Day, we step into the precinct, we cast our vote, and we really don't give much thought as to exactly what it takes to produce that actual ballot. So would you walk us through the process step by step? How is that ballot created?
Well, I don't personally prepare the ballot, but from what I can tell you is that the ballot is created by typically the county clerk or the county election director, and it's proofed multiple times. And then it goes to the State Bureau of Elections to also be proofed and approved. Then it is submitted to the printing company to be printed, packaged, mailed to all of the clerks around the state.
And my understanding is that a proof ballot has to go to every candidate, make sure that the name is spelled right. So there's a lot of hoops to jump through before it goes off to the printer.
That is correct. So not only laying it out in the correct format, there's, you know, fonts requirements and size requirements, layout requirements. There's also the requirement of literally mailing it to everybody to have them check off to say, yes, my name is spelled correctly on the ballot. And they have, you know, 48 hours typically or to respond to that.
And so how long would this typically take?
I'm going to say we would love to have at least 3 weeks. However, you know, you've also got to give the printing companies time to print the ballots. At this point, from what I've heard, we're right against the deadlines. If the printing companies don't get these ballots till September 9, they're going to be running 3 shifts from September 9 to 23rd to get these ballots out to all the clerks.
And what's the importance of the 23rd?
That is the Military Move Act deadline. It's a state law that requires us to have our ballots 45 days prior to an election day.
So you're watching legal fighting. You're looking at the calendar. And that, are you feeling nervous?
I'm not nervous yet. I'm hoping that the Attorney General would just let this lay until after the election and let us, you know, get this presidential election passed, and then they can reevaluate it. The other problem is we deal with archaic election equipment that we've been working for 2 years. I've been on the advisory committee with the Bureau of Elections rolling out new equipment in 2017. So you already have machines that are on their last legs, and then you're going to also deal with the people that are agitated because they don't want to stand in line and they don't want to mark every oval. I personally don't feel it's a wrong thing, but I also feel that they should have the choice to mark one oval if they choose to.
In fact, help us understand, let's just say, yes, there is an end to straight ticket voting. What does that do to what the ballot actually looks like? I mean, the candidates are the same, proposals, the local questions, but what's at stake for the look and what has to be on printed on that ballot?
The number one is the top choice where it would list all of the parties, and it would list an oval where you can select one oval, and that would then give every Republican or every Democrat or whichever party a vote. That will be gone. But the other thing that this does is it removes the vignettes. So they can't lay out the ballot until this decision's made because the vignettes will be gone from the ballot if this goes through.
Sarah, these little political party vignettes we've come to know on the ballot, like the drawing of Lincoln and Reagan on the GOP side and the drawing of JFK and FDR on the Dem side, there was an effort to get rid of those, but that hasn't gone through. So where do things stand with these little vignettes?
That's correct. They used to be next to each presidential candidate, and because they did not do away with them, they will be across the top of the ballot. So because of that, with this appeal in place, they cannot even start to lay out the ballot until this decision's been made because that is the first line on the ballot.
Now, you didn't want to see an end to straight ticket voting.
I'm not opposed to it, as I said before, but I think that at this point we need to leave it on to give the voters an option because of, I feel, we will have record turnout. And also because of the machines, this may be our last election that we use these machines. And so why make the line longer? Why make the people, because it's going to take a lot of time to explain to them that they have to mark every oval. But also we're going to have a huge line due to the presidential general election. So why add to the chaos, basically?
I'm curious, what percentage of voters in Walker went straight ticket in the last presidential election?
I would say an average about 55-60%.
So that, as you say, there are a lot of people used to doing it that way.
Yes, and some counties are as high as 70%. I don't believe, I'm very involved with the Bureau of Elections. I just don't understand why some people feel, you know, it's a specific group that does that, because I feel that Republicans use the straight party voting equal or a great amount as do Democrats or one type of person over another. They're trying to say that it's a biased thing, and I disagree.
We have dealt with 11th-hour ballot changes in this state before. How
yeah.
is this different?
I would say the biggest difference is because it's a presidential general election for a new president, not a second term. So the volume of ballots that we will be dealing with will be substantially greater.
How do you see this playing out, Sarah, for you and the municipal clerks and also for voters?
To be honest, I have no idea what the ruling will be. I mean, I can only hope that it will be suspended or postponed till after the election day.
And honestly, what is like the final date? Got to be done, got to be ready, turned in. What date are you looking at?
I would say September 9.
All right.
But that's just my opinion.
Waiting and seeing. Sarah Bidalek is the Walker City Clerk, and she's president of the Michigan Association of Municipal Clerks. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside today.
You're welcome.
Stateside's producers are Ellie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.